Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,600 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Professor J. Eric Oliver, author of How to Know Yourself: The Art and Science of Discovering Who You Really Are. For more than 20 years, University of Chicago Professor J. Eric Oliver has taught a legendary course, The Intelligible Self, that students routinely describe as life-changing. Now, in How to Know Yourself, he brings the best of that classroom experience to readers everywhere, guiding us through the most profound and meaningful journey of all, understanding who we really are. With warmth, wit, and an eye for the unexpected, Professor Oliver draws on insights from neuroscience, psychology, and physics. He is the author of 5 previous books on subjects ranging from the politics of obesity to magical thinking in American life. For more information, you can visit his website, which is www.jericoliver.com, and that's the letter jericoliver.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Eric to the show. Good day, Eric.
Hi, Robert. It is great to be here.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. You touched on so many different areas, and it's going to be really good to get your opinion. So first of all, how did this book come about? What was the spark or the inspiration for the book?
Well, so as you mentioned in the introduction, I have been teaching this class at the University of Chicago for over 20 years, and the class came about from my own self-explorations and interest in subjects like neuroscience and philosophy and Buddhism. And I thought, well, here'd be an interesting opportunity to try to put these subjects in conversation with each other. And I'm lucky that I have some of the smartest and most hardworking students around, and they are great to tackle interesting ideas with. And so I started putting this class together, and something magical happened. The class seemed to really strike a note with my students. They seemed to be getting so much out of it, and so I kept offering it year after year. And then a few years ago, I would start telling adults about the class, and they would say, well, do you have a book to recommend? That sounds great. And I said, well, I have 200 books to recommend. And I thought, okay, well, maybe here's an opportunity to do something useful. Because if you look out there, there are hundreds and hundreds of books telling us how we can improve ourselves or help ourselves. But none of these books really describe what this self is that we're supposed to be improving. And so I thought, okay, here's an opportunity to try to bring all this great wisdom from around the world and to answer this fundamental question about what the self is, but even more importantly, why it so often malfunctions and what we can do to make it work better.
Yeah. Yeah. And I noticed in reading the book that there was a point in teaching the class to the students, you mentioned that there was a point that you had the students basically indicate how some of these thinkers or, you know, ideas, how they impacted them, and that, you know, personal experience had a big impact on how the students perceive the class.
Yes, you know, when I first started teaching the class, it was a traditional seminar in that we had these great works and we would see what these august thinkers like Nietzsche or Freud would tell us about ourselves. And that was good. But at a point, I have to admit, it was almost selfish because I was like, I got kind of tired of reading the same essays over and over again. And I turned to my students one week and I just said, listen, you're really smart. You can tell me what, for example, what Freud says, and I know you know what Freud says. That's less interesting to me. I want to hear what Freud tells you about your own lived experience. How do we take the ideas that we're grappling with here and translate them into our own, you know, just everyday moment. And when I did that, the course really came alive. And suddenly the weekly reflections my students were writing became very personal. They started, you know, sharing all kinds of challenging emotions, challenging experiences, very kind of personal details. And I realized that, oh, this is a much different form of education that I think we often lose sight of in our modern universities, which just tend to be very abstract and idea-oriented, and yet is really, really vital in helping people craft a better way of living in their own skin. And so in a lot of ways, that's kind of what the class is about. It's about how to live more comfortably in your own self-processes.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because I think hopefully what the ultimate response is after reading a book like that, is that how can it improve my life? How does it affect me, and how do the ideas improve my life?
Yes, and I think at some point in time, we all are going to ask that question. And for some of us, like myself, it's a perpetual question. And, you know, other times it often comes up when we have a setback. You know, we might have a heartbreak or experience a loss or, you know, lose a job or something like that. Or even, you know, in the situation where we've worked hard for certain goals and we've even achieved those goals, and then we're left with this, oh, is that all there is? You know, all mm-hmm. this, you know, expectation of, you know, bliss and happiness and no more troubles doesn't come to pass. And then, so there's a question of like, huh, okay, well, what am I really doing here? And in a lot of ways, that's what the subject of the course is, and that's what the subject of the book is. How can we figure out a way of living better in this own experience that we inhabit?
Yeah, that's great. Now, the title of your book, you separate the words your and self. It was, you know how to know yourself. So can you tell us why it was not know yourself, one word?
Sure. And I think in order to answer that question, I might have to describe a little bit more about what the self is first. So if you don't mind,
perfect.
Let me go ahead and answer that first, and then we'll lead into your original question.
That's
so
perfect.
If we want to understand what's behind this experience of being or inhabiting, we need to go to our fundamental core essence. And our fundamental core essence is energy. We are comprised of energy. We are an energy system. Like everything else in the cosmos, we are fundamentally comprised of energy. Your body is mostly energy. There's actually very little matter there. If you look at each of your atoms and molecules, there's only really tiny specks of real matter. Most of it's just energy floating around. And we are not just energy, though. We're alive. And what distinguishes us from being alive is that we are an energy system that is pushing back against the great degradation of the universe. The universe is decaying in its energy potential. It's making fewer stars and galaxies. At some point in time, it's going to stop making them all together. And this is what physicists call entropy. It's the sort of great degradation that's been occurring since the Big Bang. And everything in the universe is, you know, quietly just, you know, acceding to this entropy, except for one thing, and that's life. And we have this, what I call a life force, and it's all the ways that this energy system that's within us is keeping itself going in the face of entropy. It's keeping the flame of life alight. And now here's where the self comes in, because basically the self are all the processes that this energy system uses to negotiate with reality and keep itself going. And we can see this in our single-celled ancestors. This was basically in their cellular structures, their metabolism, their cell walls, their actions of reproduction. As you move forward in time and our ancestors become multicellular, it became the ways that this animal self began developing perceptions and sense organs and brains, and, you know, bodily metabolism, and all these kinds of things. And that's, all of these are expressions of these self processes. And what that means is that we are, this experience of being that we have, this self, is very, very deep. It goes down to our cells. It goes up to the ways these cells coordinate. And then, of course, we have something very special because we're human beings. And that makes us different from every other living thing on the planet because we have language. And what language allows us to do, it was really a revolutionary moment in life. Language begins or gives us the ability to reshape these self-processes in ways that we want. All other animals, their self-processes are honed by millions of years of evolution. They're largely determined by their DNA. You know, they don't really refashion themselves in any kind of intentional way. Once we start speaking, however, we gain self-awareness. And this goes then back to your original question, because the self is something that all, I would say all living things have a self or have self-processes that help them negotiate their life force and reality. Humans are the only creatures with a yourself. And because what is yourself is a reflexive pronoun. And it reflects our ability to contemplate our own existence, to hold a mirror up to our own existence and peer back at it and say, oh, yes, that's me. I can become an object of my own subjective experience here. And that's what pronouns basically do for us. And that's what yourself is. So this self that you have is a complex myriad of biological and psychological and cultural forces. But yourself, you know, as a singular word, is the you, is that identity that we too often, I think of as the totality of ourselves, when in a lot of ways, it's just more of like a surface layer on this much more dynamic stew of kind of energy and culture and biology kind of operating beneath the surface.
Yeah, that explained it. Well, you know, because I don't think people often make a distinction between yourself, oneself, and, you know, yourself. So, I mean, like, it's, to me, it seems most people will have that surface understanding.
Right. And I think it reflects our intuitions. I know, like, my intuition is that when I think of myself, I think of myself as a relatively solid, static thing. It's hard to know that this me that I feels like it's been a continuity, a singular continuity throughout my whole life, that it seems like unified in its intentionality, and that it's hard to imagine it's not going to go on forever. In fact, I cling to that. But that is an illusion. We're not things. We are processes. Or another way of thinking about it, we're not nouns. We're really verbs. If you look at just your body, there's no part of you that's static. You're constantly swapping trillions and trillions and trillions of molecules in and out of your body every moment. Your cells are constantly regenerating. Even the thoughts in your head are ephemeral electrical impulses. They don't last. If you could see this just, you know, if you try to close your eyes and picture, for example, your mother's face, you might be able to do that for a few seconds. But inevitably that image will fade and something else will displace it. And that's because the way your thoughts go, they're continually regenerating and regenerating. So there's nothing static about us. We are dynamic processes. And on the one hand, that's kind of hard because, you know, we like to think of the world in terms of things. Things are legible to us. They're stable. We know what to expect. Processes are more slippery. They have more variability to them. It's hard to really know what's going on. But on the other hand, if we can come to see our own existence as a process, it opens up all kinds of new possibilities for us to live in a better way. And I'll just give a simple example of that. At various points in my life and with various people I know, I sometimes get this feeling that, oh, I'm a terrible person. I'm a broken person. You know, I'm just bad. Like, and I sort of just, you know, load that onto my own experience in that way. And that's, of course, an illusion in many, many regards. If you think of yourself not as a bad person, a thing, but as a process, it's more like, oh, instead of being a bad person, maybe I'm a process that's out of alignment right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you take away that kind of moral baggage that gets attached to it. and you can begin to see yourself a little bit more and experience yourself even a little bit more objectively and, you know, with a little bit more ease and some of those kind of negative conceptions that we hold so tightly about ourselves begin to kind of lose their power over us.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you view it that way, that, you know, it's not me, a bad person, but it's simply a process that is kind of out of alignment, then it kind of reduces the self-judgment that would seem to follow, and also gives hope to the fact that it's just a matter of looking and tweaking a process rather than something innate to my being.
Yes, exactly. And it's in that space where we can actually really improve, make big, big improvements to our existence.
Yeah, I understand. Now, I'm going to go ahead and mention, give a shout out to a teacher. You, in your book, you talk about Mrs. Malone, a high school English teacher who put on the board, know thyself. And here you are many years later talking about and promoting knowing oneself. So, you know, it's, to me, I think teachers don't realize that some of the impact that they can have on their students may end up being something that guides their life and their journey.
Yeah, I tell the story in the book. So, you know, in my bumpy adolescence, I had this remarkable high school English teacher, Mrs. Malone, and she was just one of these magical teachers who could take a bunch of, you know, hormone-addled teenagers and get us interested in writers like, you know, Dostoevsky or, you know, Dickinson. And one day she wrote Know Thyself on the blackboard, and then we were all like, huh? And she said, okay, here we have crystallized into two words the entire wisdom of the ancient Greeks, you know, the founders of philosophy and mathematics and drama and so much architecture that we know. And these are really, really smart people. And what are they telling us? They're telling us that if we want to live a happy, fulfilled, and meaningful life, at some level, we have to know ourselves. Otherwise, we're just living according to somebody else's program. Now, at a young age, and given how much reverence I had for Mrs. Malone, I took her words to heart. And that actually is, in some ways, what initiated this lifelong quest to try to know the self. Now, here's the funny thing, because it's actually the story gets a little more complicated at this point. The ancient Greeks, it turned out, did not really have a word that meant self in the way that we have a word that means self. And when they were saying, know thyself, what they were really saying is something more like, know thy place. In other words, it meant know who you are relative to the demands of the group. And funnily enough, you know, I think for most of human history, that's probably the best advice you could live by. You know, our ancestors typically lived in small tribes, you know, on the verge of survival with a really precarious existence. And if you really wanted to sustain yourself, you had to stick with the group. You had to follow what the group told you to do. You had a pretty strict social role. You didn't really worry about finding true love because your marriage was probably arranged for you. You didn't worry about finding that great job because it was given to you. You were told you were going to be a hunter or gatherer or something like that. And you really didn't even worry about finding meaning in life because your tribe had a bunch of stories and myths and folktales that told you what it was all about. And so you lived kind of tightly ensconced with that. And what we see in the West is about 300 years ago, with the growth of the Enlightenment and then later with capitalism and a market economy, that shifted away. And what became primal, prime was the individual. So we are now individuals with liberties and rights. We are individuals who can find jobs for ourselves. In romance, we go onto a dating market and, you know, meet others. But it also means that it's created, I think, kind of a crisis for us because a lot of times we don't really know what the meaning of life is. What is our purpose in life? We've been freed from our ancestors' dogmas, but on the other hand, we've also been kind of cast off from the very secure net and web of explanations they had for who and where they fit in the universe. So in a lot of ways, what knowing yourself now means is trying to figure out a new way of understanding what's behind this experience of being I am having. What is my purpose in life? How do I make sense of that? And in a lot of ways, this is something else that the book really tries to get at these kind of deeper, important questions.
Yeah. Now, in the beginning of the book, in the introduction, you tell a story that you indicate still haunts you. It's about your grandfather and a black man named George who drives a, quote, honey wagon. So could you recount that story for listeners? Because I think that story really gets to the heart of the message of your book.
Sure. So I grew up in Southeast Texas, and my grandfather, who grew up in Southeast Texas in the early 1900s, used to tell me the story of his neighborhood, and they didn't have sewage or plumbing. And so the family relieved themselves in a little shed out behind the house that they charmingly called the small house. So if you had to go do your business, you went out to the small house and then went into a little bucket. And then every day, this guy named George would drive a horse-drawn wagon around with a big copper tank in the back. And he'd have to go by all of the houses and empty out the buckets and, you know, put the buckets into the copper tank. And if you've ever spent any time in Southeast Texas, you know it is a brutally hot and humid climate, especially May through October. It's regularly over 95 degrees with really high humidity. And growing up in this environment and suffering through those summers, you know, I was thinking about George. Here he is without air conditioning, not only having to deal just with his own issues, but now he has to deal with everybody's crap literally every day in this swampy oven. And I just imagine like flies, much less the, you know, the smell. And the remarkable thing was that my grandpa said that George, he loved telling me the story. He said, you know, the funny thing about George is he always had the biggest smile on his face. He seemed like one of the happiest people I knew. And so I've always thought about this story year after year. And I've always wondered, like, okay, on the one hand, is George this great hero? Is he somebody who's been thrust into this miserable job? You know, Texas in that period of time was a very racist place. So George probably had few options of where he could find work. And maybe this was the best job he could get. And so his whole attitude is, well, okay, I'm in this miserable circumstance, but I'm not going to let it define me. I'm going to rise above it. I'm going to put on a brave face, and I'm not going to let others look down on me because I drive the honey wagon. And, you know, and I think that's kind of the inspiring interpretation of the story. But I don't think that's the really what's going on. And I think instead, my suspicion is that George actually hates his job, but he's gotten so used to it and accustomed to it that he can't imagine any alternative. And that to me is the more haunting interpretation, because I think in a lot of the ways this accounts for a lot of us. We all pull our own honey wagons around. Mm-hmm. We all have those habits and emotional tendencies that we just can't seem to let go of, those recursive thoughts that keep us trapped in loops of anxiety or resentment or discontentment. And those are our own honey wagons, yet we hold on to them and we continue to pull them along because I think at some level we're too afraid to let go of them, or we just can't imagine a life without them. And this is really what knowing yourself is all about. It's beginning to recognize what are the honey wagons that you're pulling around and how might you learn to let go of them.
You indicate that the brains tend to create a constant background noise of anxiety. And so is this kind of what you're talking about, that might be the source of that anxiety?
That's a big part of it. Because this is one of the unfortunate byproducts of when we started talking as a species. We not only, you know, it was great in a lot of ways. Wow, we could develop all these nifty tools and technologies. We could start growing crops. You know, we elevated ourselves to the top of the food chain. We came to dominate the planet. So definitely had some upsides for us as a species. But the downside was not only, you know, are we kind of aware of ourselves, but we become aware of our own mortality. And we become disconnected in a lot of ways from what our animal self is. You know, we develop rules and laws and morals that we then internalize. So, you know, my tribe tells me that, you know, I shouldn't think about eating red fruits. And so I sometimes see red fruits and I really want one. And then I feel bad about myself. That's how I police myself, is by regulating my own behavior. And then I do this just so regularly and habitually, I think that that's all I need to do to sustain myself. When in fact, maybe those red fruits are something that could be very nutritious for me. And that's kind of a metaphor for, I think, a lot of what we do. We oftentimes, from an early age, develop these habits of mind. And we think that we have to think certain things or think about ourselves in certain ways because that's necessary for our survival. We think that, for example, we have to only connect with people who might be, say, oftentimes mean to us because that was our early experience, was maybe dealing with an abusive parent. And so we think of, you know, abuse in some ways as our love language, to kind of abuse that phrase. And it's so deeply embedded within the habits of our minds, and we hold on to them, and we don't really imagine an alternative. You know, that becomes this, you know, misaligned state of being becomes our honey wagon that we just hold on to and keep carrying around. And a lot of that is just has to do with the way our brains are wired. Our brains get very used to serve certain ways of having certain ways of processing information. And once we get used to those ways, it's very hard to pull us off those habits because our brains think that's what we need for survival.
Yeah. In talking about the holding on to thoughts and stories, a lot of those things can make us miserable. You know, like, for example, even the red fruit example, you know, that if I'm constantly confronted, you know, with red fruit and it's not, My thought process is that it's not good for me, then it's going to create that kind of adverse emotional reaction. So when it comes to the idea of identifying those thoughts or stories that make us miserable, how does one differentiate, you know, from what, you know, what is a story that we can reprogram, or something that is something to keep in mind to continue?
Right. And that's the tough question, because the simple fact of the matter is there's no one clear answer for that. And this is something that we always have to continually reevaluate for ourselves. And so, you know, for example, we might live according to certain kinds of values or rules or expectations. And those are really great rules for helping us thrive. You know, so for example, rules that say eat a healthy meal, get a lot of sleep, be kind to other people. Turns out those are great rules as far as if you just look at it in terms of your own self-optimization and how you can live, you know, a fulfilled, full, long, happy life. Wow. Mm-hmm. Kind of following those things, that's great. On the other hand, you know, getting preoccupied with, you know, equating your own self-worth with accomplishments, or, you know, getting enough likes on an Instagram post, or, you know, staying in a relationship with someone who is abusive or not respectful to you. Those are rules too, in a lot of ways. There's certain kinds of rules, and where we oftentimes end up following them. And of course, those are not going to lead us to kind of a healthy, fulfilling, long-term satisfied life. And so the question is, how do you then know? And then you need to look to some guidance. And this is where, you know, the first step in really optimizing yourself comes in saying that, oh, okay, how do I begin to recognize what's really going on, you know, under the hood with me? What are the mechanics of my being? How can I see what those mechanics require to function really, really well?
Yeah, I can see where it would take a lot of introspection in order to be able to distinguish between, you know, the two.
Yeah, and it does. And it's, you know, on the one hand, it requires introspection and this, you know, creating a capacity for yourself to be able to kind of observe your own processes, be it your thoughts or your feelings or your actions, with a little bit of distance, a little bit of objective distance. So you're not like, oh my God, how could I think that? But rather, oh, huh, that's interesting. That was my thought. It's a curious kind of thing to be thinking. So you're, you know, evaluating yourself with less judgment and more objectively. And then the second part of it is finding people who can reflect back to you and, you know, and reflect your own processes back to you. And I think in throughout most of history, this typically was, you know, the village elder or the parish priest or, you know, someone typically within a spiritual tradition that allowed us to do this. In our kind of increasingly secular society, that's been kind of supplanted by therapy. And so going and seeing a therapist who in some ways is like the literary critic of your own life for you, you know, is reflecting your stories back to you and giving you a new lens by which to sort of reevaluate things that are happening to you that might not be so easy for you to see because you get so compressed in the moment.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Now, there was one part, and it was that ancient self-preservation systems inherited from Luca, our 3.7 billion year old ancestor, still govern modern behavior. So I have no idea who is Luca and how could that be, you know, that kind of thing be so ingrained for so long?
Sure. So let me introduce Luca. And this is someone who I met recently, I should say, in the course of teaching this class and doing work on this book. So every living thing on Earth right now, from the most obscure slime mold to the grandest redwood tree to you and me, we are all genetic cousins. And we all share about 350 genes. And all of these genes trace back billions of years to an early microbial ancestor. And biologists call this ancestor Luca, which stands for last universal common ancestor. And they estimate that Luca lived about 3.7 billion years ago. And Luca is, if we want to look really for what the origin of life is, we don't really know how our life processes started. There are a lot of theories and speculations about it. But if we want to sort of pinpoint one point where we say, okay, from this point forward, life as we know it is existing, and that's Luca. And what's interesting about Luca is that Luca had a self. Luca had a life force that was perpetuating it as a energy system. It was taking in energy. It was protecting itself from threats, and it was reproducing. And all of those are the elements of the life force. And that's where the beginnings of the self really happens. Now, okay, well, that's a long time ago. What does that mean for how we live now? Well, I think it's important to understand a couple of things about Luca, is that we are beings comprised of cells. And so in a lot of ways, each of our cells, the trillions of cells that comprise our body, are similar to Luca, which was a single-celled organism. And these cells all have the same thing that Luca was trying to do. They're trying to take in energy, keep themselves alive, and keep us going. And so at our base level, at a foundational level, if we want to learn to optimize ourselves, we need to take heed of what our individual cells need. And how can we do that? And interestingly enough, the answer is pretty straightforward. It's, you know, eating properly, eating, you know, a lot of organic fruits and vegetables, laying off the saturated fats, refined carbohydrates, alcohol, getting enough sleep, and actually having meaningful contact with other people. That seems to even affect ourselves at that level. Okay, sounds simple, sounds straightforward. Why is that so hard? Well, that's because of what happens at the sort of next layer of being what I would call our animal self, is how our multicellular creature, you know, this multicellular creature that is us, what it's trying to do. But even at just that cellular level, we can think that, oh, okay, here's an opportunity for us to begin to take care of ourselves.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to know who Luca is. and I recognize that, you know, way long ago, there's this common ancestor. So one of the things that you also talk about is why letting go and not striving harder is often the key to psychological freedom. And I'll just say that it seems that society really promotes striving harder, and letting go is sometimes gets a bad rap as being weak.
Yes, Robert, I'm glad you brought this up, because this is one of the things that I see most commonly with my students and many adults that I meet, which is, I call this the gold star illusion. And I think we're taught at a young age that if we want to live this happy life, we need to rack up accomplishments. You know, we need to go to that best school. We need to get the more prestigious job. We need to make more money. We need to date somebody who's more attractive, all of these things. And if we can just win all our gold stars, then eternal happiness awaits us at the end. And of course, once you get to your mid-30s, most people I know realize that, wow, it doesn't really work that way. Even if you collect your gold stars, you're still going to have challenges. You're still going to have setbacks. You're still going to have pain and discomfort. And I think that reflects then, okay, well, what do you do at that moment? And this is where letting go comes in. I think to rebalance these self-processes that define us, rebalance our unhelpful ways of thinking, our, you know, discomforting emotions, these kind of cycles of negativity, our self-defeating behaviors that we get into, we first need to both recognize what is going on and kind of develop a framework for understanding why are we acting that way. And then really solving it ultimately says, well, how can I let go of those bad habits? How can I let go of feeding those emotional cycles that keep me trapped in, you know, states of anxiety or anger or whatnot? And that's a challenge, because letting go in some ways is counterintuitive. It's a deceptively hard way to sort of solve your problems. But the fact of the matter is, the more that you can learn how to let go, the easier life will become, and the less those problems will haunt you in the future. And I'll give you an example of this. So I, you know, sometimes get very, very preoccupied with, you know, am I doing well enough at work? And mm-hmm. and I'll equate my whole sense of being with how, you know, am I getting this acknowledgement? Am I getting this award? Did I get this pay raise? Why did my coworker get this great pay raise and award and I didn't, you know? And then I'm stuck in this loop of like anger and resentment and jealousy, and I just feed it, and it goes over and over again. And in the moment, that's all I see. I can't see past that. I'm so compressed in that emotion that it seems the totality of my existence. The more you can begin to sort of step back and say, okay, this is just my ego talking. This is not me. This is just some misadjustments in my self-processes. I'll still get those thoughts. They still keep coming up. They'll still gnaw at me. But the moment I can step back from them and not feed them, they start to get more quiet and distant. And eventually, they just fade away altogether. And then I'm like, oh. You know, it's like a fever that breaks. And, you know, do you feed these kind of feverish existences, or do you see them with detachment? And the more you see them with detachment, the softer, quieter, and more quickly they dissipate.
Yeah, that's a good way to approach problems and some of the negative thinking cycles that we often put upon ourselves.
Yeah, I find it very useful, for example, when I catch myself in one of those cycles, just to ask myself, okay, is this thought that I'm having helping anything? Mm. Just asking myself that simple question. And more often than not, the answer is no. It's like, oh, okay. Well, then why am I holding on to it? What am I doing with this unhelpful thought? And so that's a trick you can start, you know, asking. It's an easy way to ask yourself. Now, a lot of times, then the thought comes barging back in. I'm like, oh. Then you take a deep breath. Then you try to let go of it again. And, you know, the more you do that, though, the more you can kind of make that replace that as your mental habit, the much less encumbered your whole sense of being becomes.
Yeah. In changing thought patterns or reactive kinds of emotions can take some time. I mean, it takes a long time to establish them. So it'd be understandable that it takes a lot of time to adjust and shift them as well.
Yeah, and I find it useful also to remember what neuroscience tells us, which is that our brain is ostensibly a prediction machine. Our senses exist to take in information from the world, and then our brain is there to process this information to kind of make a map of reality and predict what it thinks is going to happen next. And that's very, very important for our survival as an animal. You know, it helps us navigate through the world with a great deal of ease. The challenge as a prediction machine is that our brain really wants to look for patterns. It really, really wants to find patterns, even when patterns don't exist. Or it really relies on old routines and habits in order to make those predictions. And a lot of those old routines and habits are outdated. It's, you know, imagine, for example, you know, most of us, when we go to work, we have one way we go to work and we get used to it and we just go that way every day. And then imagine, like, there suddenly is a new way to go to work that's 5 minutes quicker, but we don't take it because we're so used to just going to the work the same way and, you know, same way and same way again. And that's a lot of our lives. We don't really, we miss opportunities for making things far less difficult for ourselves than they need to be. And that's because of these old habits of this prediction machine brain that we have.
It would be great to be able to identify those opportunities and make the change.
Well, and that's what I think a big part of knowing yourself is making yourself open to that possibility and sort of saying, okay, being curious about each moment. Is there something else that's out there that might give me a better way of living, a way of rethinking this? And so one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is provide people with some conceptual tools for doing this, going through and thinking about, okay, what does psychology tell us? What does philosophy tell us? What does something like Buddhism tell us about some ways of reinterpreting our experience so that we can see alternatives to what's out there?
Yeah, exactly. And so is that what you would hope the readers take away from reading How to Know Yourself?
Yes, that's really what I tell my students is, at the very least, what I hope to give them and what I'm hoping to give readers of the book is an expanded vocabulary of their own experience, to give them some tools that might help them better interpret what's going on beneath their ordinary experience of being, and with those tools, be able to gain a little perspective, maybe identify some imbalances, and start working to correct them.
Yeah. Now, Eric, I also understand that you are a podcast host. Is that correct?
That's right. In the course of writing this book, I started a podcast a few years ago called 9 Questions, where I was going around and asking interesting people the same 9 questions about the meaning of life. And that went really well. And we've now rebranded the podcast. It's going to start on the new year. And it's called Knowing with Eric Oliver, and where I go around and interview interesting, exciting, dynamic people about ideas that could help us better understand what's going on both with ourselves and the world around us.
Well, that's great. Well, I look forward to listening to that when it starts up next year. So, Eric, I really want to thank you for your time today. This has been very inspirational, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Robert, thank you so much for having me on. It's great to chat with you, and thank you for all your terrific questions.
Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Professor J. Eric Oliver, author of How to Know Yourself, The Art and Science of Discovering Who You Really Are. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, www.jericoliver.com. And everyone, thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.